Hello, I'm Megan Morris-Carter, Director of The Hill. Welcome to Series 3 of our Digital Innovation podcast. The Hill supports an ecosystem of startups, scale-ups, partners, and clinical staff interested in digital innovation, as well as managing a pipeline of innovation into Oxford University hospitals and the wider NHS. Our work supports better patient care through technology and innovation. This series explores some of the technologies that are at the cutting edge of healthcare delivery through the medium of the entrepreneurial journeys of some of the founders in our community, as well as the clinicians they have worked with to pilot their technologies. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Susan and Lydia, who've been leading the digital consent pilot at Oxford University Hospitals. And I'll start off, Susan, by asking you to introduce yourself, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us. My name is Susan Downes, and I am a consultant ophthalmologist at the Oxford Eye Hospital and Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Oxford, and I'm a specialist in medical retinal conditions.
Thank you, Susan. And Lydia?
My name is Lydia. I have been in geography since 2015, and I had been promoted to do that amazing project as project digital manager and help for the implementation in digital in ophthalmology of the digital consent.
So, Susan, you obviously kicked off this project and you were interested in piloting digital consent. Why was that, and what was the role you took in the project?
So we have to go back a little bit in time. I was approached by David Nurse from The Hill to say that the OUH were thinking of introducing digital consent. And that was probably about 2022. And at that time, we were really keen in ophthalmology because we are quite a digital speciality as it is. And what we wanted to do was try to smooth things through in the sense of saving time. So if I give you the backdrop, we have, for example, in the department, we do over 12,000 injections inside the eye for chronic disease per year. We do over 5,000 procedures in theatre per year. And we have several thousand procedures in outpatients per year. So if with that backdrop, with the time it takes to take consent, and if I can give you an example, you're in the clinic, you're seeing the patient, and you talk them through the consent, but you need to find the paper consent. This is when we're doing it paper. You have to find the paper consent itself. You have to find the labels to stick on it. Then you have to write into the consent, as we all know, we've been doing it for years. But all of those things seem quite straightforward and quite simple. But if the form isn't in the room, you have to leave the room and find the consent form, which is disruptive to the consultation. And sometimes it's not even possible to find the consent form, despite the best efforts of all the team to try and replenish the stocks in every room. It's not always possible. As you can tell from those numbers I gave you, it's very busy. And so if you can't find the form, and we'll come to that perhaps later about the audit that we did about how long it takes to do a consent form. But if I give you one example, one time it took 20 minutes to get the consent form signed because of finding the paper, finding the label. And also for the individual that actually fills in the consent form, sometimes because they're an elderly population, it might be difficult for them to sign the form on a piece of paper. You've got to find a surface for them to put it on. And then on that surface, they've got to press hard enough for it to be seen on the underlying copy as well. So that all of these things added up to make us feel that it would be nice to move this on, be more effective, more efficient, and also to make it easier for everybody.
So can you talk us through how you set up the pilot itself?
So setting it up itself, first of all, as I said, we were approached, and the first thing that we needed to do was to engage the staff. So once we agreed that we would do the pilot, engaging the staff is the key thing. And the first thing that we did was, once we had go ahead, was that Lydia got appointed, and Lydia has been absolutely key to the whole thing. But what you also required was the team. And I emailed everybody to say, we're going to do this. The lead clinician and all of the administrative staff were aware of it. All of the clinicians who were going to be engaged in having to consent were also aware of the situation. And then Lydia and I decided that we would fashion two groups. One would be consenters, and one would be viewers. And what that means is those that take the consent needed to know how to do it. So a training episode was set up, which was for each individual. And I think, Lydia, you must have done over 180 in that first 2 weeks and training them. And then the other aspect of it was to create the team. And the team involved myself, Lydia, who were driving it forward, and two trainee doctors who were very keen and interested, who had some experience in digital from another source, and also one lead from the nursing staff, one lead from the administration staff, because they needed to help all the viewers to be able to know how to see it, and also one lead from the allied health professionals, the nursing staff, who also do procedures. So we've got the team together. We started the training, and when I say we, Lydia did the training and went out there, met everybody, set up with their computer, showed them exactly how to do it, and we'll go perhaps into the minutiae of how you do it later. But it was just those engagements at the beginning, how we set the pilot up. We also had to do a couple of other things, one of which was we checked in with theatres to make sure that the consent form, the digital consent form, fitted in with the WHO form there, and that all fitted, because the WHO form in theatres has the pregnancy question on it. And when I say the pregnancy question, you know, you have to ask women between the ages of 12 to 55, are they pregnant for certain procedures? So it's incorporated into a checklist beforehand. So that was all sorted in theatres already because it was on the WHO checklist. But in outpatients, we had a myriad of different forms that we were using. And for example, for laser treatment, there'd be one form. For injections, there was another form. So I got together with the matron in our department, and she, Ali Northover, and myself spent quite a bit of time together with another nurse working on making a generic checklist so that everything was incorporated into that for all of these different procedures, minor ops, botulinum toxin, all of the things that we do, lasers, etc., all on that form. And then on that form, we also had the pregnancy question. So this was on paper at this moment in time, which complemented the consent form. And that had to go through several steps. That had to go through clinical governance, very specialised meetings, to be signed off to make sure that it was adequate and fit for purpose. We had to fill in a quality assurance project for it. Probably used the wrong terms there, but QIA anyway. And then we also had to audit it to make sure it was fit for purpose. And Lydia has led the three audits that we've done so far, and perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that later. But all these steps had to be in place before we were able to go over in the outpatients. So going back to your original question about the pilot took us, we decided to do it not in a big bang, but in a phased intervention, or phased introduction rather. So we started off with, we decided to do it on the, we would, big bang was on the 29th of January to start, but it would not be with everything. So we started off with pre-admit. So all of the relationships were made in the sense of everybody was happy that they understood the form, how to do it, how to do all the various tick-tick. And we all then went from the pre-admission outpatient to cataract surgery. And then we did all surgery. So the cataract surgery was first. So everybody who was involved in cataract surgery, both seeing the consent form, the viewers, and the people who actually took the consent form were all involved, all trained, and all had double training, in fact, because we made sure that Lydia had interfaced with them all again to make sure they were confident and happy to do it. And Lydia gave up some of her weekends to work to make sure that all of our lists at the weekends were covered as well. And some issues around that I will tell you about later in terms of what were the blocks, what were the difficulties, but let's just talk a little bit about how it happened. Then we went from cataract surgery to all procedures in theatre, and then on the second week, we went into outpatients for all procedures in outpatients, and then we completed within 2 weeks. So we were live for the whole of ophthalmology within 2 weeks, and the only outlier for us was paediatric ophthalmology, because it came under a different jurisdiction. And so the training for that had to be done separately, and the paediatric team had to be confident that they were happy with all of the different arrangements, which, if I could just mention, is access to adequate equipment. So do they have a signature pad, an iPad or a computer, all of which has Concentriv on it, and the various interfaces of EPR and Wi-Fi? And that we may want to talk about as one of the difficulties that we have faced is how do we manage to have access to adequate Wi-Fi? And a very interesting experiment that Lydia might want to tell us about, where she went into outpatients and with the team from IT mapped all of the MACs, or as we know them, routers, and saw their exact coverage. And theoretically, when you look at the pictures, the coverage is complete. But when you actually drill down and take the measurements, and they went round in the evening to do this, they found that the routers were interfering with each other, so they were having dropout in certain areas, which was why sometimes the signature pads were the best thing to use, because the iPads, which were on two different frequencies, sometimes dropped out. So that's a lot to, you know, there's a lot to tell you about, really.
This is fascinating, Susan. If I could just go back to what you mentioned about the pregnancy question, just to clarify for people. My understanding was that the paper consent forms contained this question for some procedures, and that therefore, because the digital consent form did not contain the question, we therefore had to relook at how we asked that question. Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
That's exactly right. It was on the consent form, and in theatres, it's covered off because it's on the WHO checklist. I think I'm right in saying that it's on the WHO checklist. It's certainly on the checklist preoperatively. Whereas in outpatients, we use the consent form at that point for that particular question. So going over to digital, we had to have a substitution, really, to make sure that we check that off. And so having a specific generic checklist with that question on it was important, and to make sure that the question was adequately presented, covered, and also answered as part of the auditing process after the QIA in the first place.
So it wasn't just a case of digitising what you already had, in a sense, but about rethinking the process in some ways.
And one of the things that I think advantages that's come out of all of this is that process that we sort of took for granted, actually, when we drilled down and did the audit, we found that it wasn't always asked and it wasn't always clearly represented on the form. And the other thing I didn't mention earlier on was that when we were paper only, and that was for consent and for these checklists, when you look at the actual scanned in image, sometimes only half the form was scanned in, because we did an audit of that as well. And Lydia found that a lot of the forms were not adequately, so they might miss the name or the actual procedure or the actual signature. So that was one of the big advantages of going over to digital consent, is that all of that is represented and captured in a uniform way. And clearly, clinical governance-wise, that's a very important thing.
So it sounds like these audits were quite an important part of the process, Lydia.
Well, yes. It is interesting. I have been learning a lot in that experience. First of all, is we speak about digital, but we see things as Wi-Fi who make the things more unbelievable to do the things in the hospital, because if you don't have Wi-Fi to connect with your mobile for check the multifactors, or maybe for checking the iPad things you need as usual, you realize why I need to change my work, why I need to choose paper versus digital. If you are creating me a problem with the digital, with paper, I take, I start to fill in, because I have been done for more than 20 years, how I'm going to change it? And that was one of the barriers. When you saw the program, when you teach them how to use and how they can help you to enhance the process, and not only one time, you go with them, you help them to overcome all the barriers, is when you can have results as filling the document is 260 seconds, filling now with practice, filling a consent form is 17 seconds. Wow. The difference is amazing. The only thing is change your mindset, start to believe Wi-Fi is going to work, and in fact, it has taken the steps, and everything is more easy. Your job can do it without not having the stress, what is going to happen? I'm going to feel stop doing. I need to stop to looking for help because something happened in the middle. The good thing with that digital consent is very intuitive program software, and the only is to practice. As much as you practice, as much you fast you can do it, the digital consent.
17 seconds is quite something, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that Lydia found from the audit was that the 15 minutes going down to 17 seconds. Now, what you have to extract from that is, of course, you had the discussion with the individual about what they're having done. So that's a separate thing. We're actually literally talking about the time it takes to take the consent with the signature, the tick boxes and all of that. So going from 15 minutes to find the consent form paper, and I haven't even mentioned the time it takes to scan it in. And I actually have a picture I photographed, obviously without any patient details, of the piles of forms that are still waiting from the past to be scanned in because of the digital side of it. That's taken away all of that time to scan all those things in. So the audit, looking at the time it takes to do the consent, has been a real validation having gone down this road.
And there are presumably going to be some other benefits, like, for example, if patients consent to research and things like that, that presumably it's going to be easier for us to find those patients to ask them if they want to take part in a study if all of those records are online.
In my point of view, the benefit from the patient view is you are going to have all the information who can't receive by mobile or by email, and you can go and check more information that the doctor gave you. Because it is a process, but also for the patient, it is a process to know what they have signed or what they are going to sign. In the past, people signed the consent and they believed the doctor because it wasn't any option. Now is you can't sign the consent in advance, and you can have that information about the sign in your mobile or in your iPad, or if you want it, you can receive printed the consent. And you can go through, you can know what it is, and more information which it was missing in the past.
So we're working on the consent for research at the moment. That's being explored and it's not entirely completely ready yet. But it will be very good from that perspective. As Lydia says, having that ease of access to send information. Because one of the things about this digital consent is you can just email the patient directly after, with their permission, and that's what part of when you're signing it on the digital consent form, when they sign across either the iPad or the trackpad, signature pad, I mean, we can send them all the information. Like, we've got a research registry in the eye department, and we can incorporate that into it as well.
And it is very interesting in AMD injection. Now, also, when you consent the patient, they receive a video with all the information, which sometimes is you're struggling to read all the information, but you have a link and you can see more information through a video, which is more interactive with the patient.
And that's before the consent, is it?
You can send it to them before the consent, because there's the option of having 24-hour or longer, as you know, a remote consent. So, but for injections, you tend to, if it's urgent, for something like age-related macular degeneration, it might need to be done on the day. But this video can be sent to them. It's a podcast. It can be sent to them directly, pre-consent, if they're not, haven't have it on the same day. But they can see the video. We could arrange for them to see it within the department if necessary. So it's phenomenal, really.
That's fantastic. Yeah, so it sounds like the patients potentially get better information back to them as well, both pre-consent in terms of having multimedia approaches to explaining the procedure, but then also they get a copy of their consent.
Yes.
and they're able to take that home. They're able to think through what the implications of the procedure might be for them, and that's easier to do.
And also, if they address to the doctor because they have doubts, it's more clearly what is the doubt, you know, because they have writing and they know, oh, I read that, what mean that? And the doctor can explain more.
And they can have frequently asked questions, which brings me on to the other point I wanted to make about the booklets and the information, because prior to digital consent, we had made information leaflets for all the patients for specific subjects, and we've been working on them for years. And we had one for age-related macular degeneration, one for cataract surgery. We have a whole panoply of these leaflets. And what's really good is that with the digital consent, using Concentric, you can have all of our OUH information sheets that we've made and have been through really careful clinical governance, as well as others that are available across the UK. But I think that's a real advantage for patients. They get access to more information. I mean, we can just hand them thousands of leaflets, some from the Macular Society or from other support groups. But this way, if they've been through the system in the sense of being approved in clinical governance, they can be there and available for patients.
It sounds like there's lots of benefits for both the patients and for the people who are taking the consent. Lydia, it obviously took you a while to get there. I think you mentioned, Susan, sort of 180 people in the first week that were trained. I mean, how many people do you think you've talked to across the department so far?
I cannot tell you the number. But what in the beginning, what we did in the pilot project was taking the timing from 100 consents. We chose 50 cataract and 50 injections. And what we see is we observe how is the reaction. We see the older patients, especially those between 80 and 90 years, had varying reaction when asked to sign consent, because we saw them on the iPad or we saw the mobile, because the patient can't sign by the mobile. And that reactions tell us how we make the things more easy for them. And also how we adapt that technology and the mindset for the patients. We see also another barrier, what was finding the right time to train all the people. And that is amazing, because more of the people was available and they was keen to understand. And also they make a lot of feedback with me, which it was very good for the implementation, because we see how they struggle. They see in the beginning who is going to be the consultant and who decide what happened if the patient doesn't have hands to sign it, for example, or is blind. And we prepare us before putting the go live.
It sounds like an amazing amount of work, Lydia. You've done a fantastic job here of kind of helping the whole department get up to speed with this. I mean, would you say you're now completely up to speed? Is it business as usual, or are there still challenges to come?
So in my point of view, after we implemented, it was more 2-3 weeks, the service, the number of paper consent versus digital consent now is zero. In the beginning, the first month, we have a challenge, and we maybe was 10% of people who is still using paper. But today, everyone is digital. For me, it's a successful implementation.
Yeah, but I think the patient feedback is going to be very interesting, isn't it? Sort of seeing how people view this. And you have done some conversation with patients already, I think, Lydia, haven't you?
I had conversations how can I say that? It is the patient who hate technologies, and for them is, please don't give me any copy. If you know I can access there, I will ask for a copy of the digital consent. And they are other patients who say, why you don't do that for everything. Because for them, the technology or the people who are more technology, what they don't want is to have the information split in papers in different ways. They have to have evident all the things in the same place, easy to access when I need it. And for them, it's fantastic to have it, that information in advance of the surgery. And
yeah, so for cataract surgery, it's been a real winner because the information can all go out beforehand. Patients can have the opportunity to read it. Very happy with that. And as Lydia was referring to, some people are not necessarily that keen to get it. They can just say, no, don't send me anything, but they can sign. And it's much easier to sign if you have any arthritic issues with your hands. So you can just put a finger and just sign with your finger rather than having to hold a pen. And you can put the iPad on their lap or bring the signature pad over.
So it sounds like there are some benefits to digital consent for patients who perhaps have access needs, but there's also some people who would prefer that paper copy. And as I understand it, we can actually print out a paper copy for them after they've signed. Is that correct?
Correct.
Correct. It's not too much people who ask me to print it, honestly, because I'm monitoring that, how many people ask for the printing. And so far, I have only two persons who I printed from February until now. Two people.
And when you were talking about the percentages of people who were doing digital versus paper at the beginning, so in that first 2 weeks, how many were you doing in that? There was a period of time where you had over 900 digital consents. Was that over a period of 1 week or 2 weeks? I can't remember. But there was a significant number of patients who had, we just went from paper to digital very, very easily. And the few that didn't sign on the digital were because either they had a long-lasting consent, as in AND, you can sign a paper consent form, and it holds true for a period of time because it's a course. So they would not have a digital consent until the next time that they had to renew that course of treatment. And also the paediatric side of it, as I mentioned earlier, where paediatric ophthalmology consents have not completely taken off yet. They're just on the verge of it as we speak today.
So are there any patients at this point in time within the kind of more core services you're talking about who can't use this system, or do you think it's accessible to everyone?
I think it's completely accessible to everybody.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Because often digital technology, I think we are worried about rising inequality or, you know, having access issues or people not being able to use it. But it sounds like this actually has some benefits for patients who perhaps might find signing with a pen difficult.
Clearly, if you have no vision, then you have to have the process around that, which was the same for paper consent. But with digital technology for people who are visually impaired, it's actually better because you can enlarge it and make it clearer to see. So I think, and the signature pad where you actually make the signature is bigger and bolder and easier to see, and you can see where you've traced your finger more easily than the little difficult thing with a pen and the scribbling and moving the board and all the aspects that we know about so well when we're trying to balance it on the edge. Because we work in the eye department where we have a slit lamp and we don't have formal desks. So scratching on the edge of that or trying to find something to lean on is quite difficult.
Fantastic. I'd like to take you back, Lydia, to some of the challenges that you face with the implementation. I think several of them have come up as we've been talking. One of them that you mentioned was the Wi-Fi, and you mentioned going round with the IT team to sort of assess that. Did you also get support in improving that? What happened with the Wi-Fi?
We know in the hospital, or we assume in the hospital, we have that Wi-Fi and nobody can access them. Because it happened that we thought it's not a problem at all until you start to go to digital consent and you realize how it's possible in a hospital you cannot get notifications inside. You need to go to the street to get that in notifications and not get it here. And also you can start to see the AP, I think, is points, access points on the selling, and some of them was green, some of them was red, but because we assume that is the line or the Wi-Fi we have, nobody start to complain until we going on live and we start to have struggles in theaters because people cannot see the digital consent. We have struggles in the moment we move on from another world and people cannot go to make a digital consent because the Wi-Fi is not working. And that was the idea. Wi-Fi is not working. It is what it is. But in fact, what it happened is the device doesn't have enough energy to connect with the devices. The connectivity is completely different. We have Wi-Fi who works perfectly, but our devices cannot connect with them. That was a very intense complaint constantly with IoT until finally they were involved and was one of the persons, if I remember correct, who came to the service and they start to check how was the connectivity. And that, as Professor Downs mentioned, they see we have a big problem, not about Wi-Fi, but about how many other interruptions or maybe another programs who are working in the same place make more difficult the connectivity with that Wi-Fi in general. So far, they are working on it, has improved a lot. Now you can go to different places and don't have any problem with your mobile or with the iPad to have the Wi-Fi with a very high level of connectivity.
If I may interrupt, I remember, Lydia, we thought that when walking around and looking at this, well, we thought it's interesting that this project has enabled us to move a situation which was quite bad for everybody, which was accepted by everyone as the norm. But this project has opened up the thought, actually, we could have better Wi-Fi. This could work better for us all. And so it's led to a mapping of the whole area, improvements in it. And that is a consequence of the project, that that it's been sort of unearthed, that there's been this problem with Wi-Fi for ever since we moved into that building. So I think it's been actually quite a useful push and a nudge to improve the Wi-Fi.
And in a sense, getting that basic infrastructure right is really important for all sorts of digital technology, isn't it? So you might then be able to use other things as
well. It's key. It really is. And I think that those extra... But I think this project has highlighted it because we really needed to be able to use the iPads. And when you walk from the ward to the theatre and the signal, that you know you can use it in certain places, but there are places where signal just drops and you couldn't. But this has been the head of the project, Bill Renwick, has been working very hard with the teams to try to improve this, and they've taken it up. And it isn't just about the eye hospital or the OUH site. It's also about how we interface with our sites elsewhere, because ophthalmology has got satellite sites such as Wantage, and all the difficulties with liaising with another provider, which is the Oxford Community Hospital, and their hardware and our software, and how does it all relate? How does it all interlink? How do we make it work? Because we do clinics out there for age-related macular degeneration, glaucoma. So all these things need to be supported in the same way as they are centrally, and they're working on that too. So it's high, and Horton, all of these things have been looked at and ironed out as a consequence, or are being ironed out as a consequence of this project.
Obviously, you did a pilot first and then implemented the solution in ophthalmology. What were the challenges of having to pilot things, and how has that helped, do you think, the wider institutional rollout?
So when you look at that question, you think, why don't you just go big bang and introduce it straight away? And we were all set to introduce it in November and go digital in ophthalmology as the pilot. And we found actually that we couldn't do that because there were certain things that needed to be sorted first. And one of them is that on the concentric consent form, there is no longer the pregnancy checklist question. So we had to therefore set up a whole different procedure, as in, so we had to set up a checklist, a generic checklist first, in order to be able to make sure that we'd cover that question off. And you asked, I mean, this is sort of answers your second question, is that, okay, so we were held back because we had to do that, and we had to go through clinical governance. We had to make sure that the new checklist question covered off that question that was originally on the paper consent. But it enabled us to show that it could be done. We did it. And then the rest of the trust then has to obviously make sure that for their departments, they're happy that that question is covered off, but there is a pathway to do that. And the pilot study enabled us to show that pathway and make it easier for people to follow a particular route to get that question, to make sure that it's appropriate and covered off by their particular checklist.
And also, I would like to add, it wasn't implemented, that WHO checklist, in our department in outpatients. And how Ali Northover and the other healthcare, they adapted and now they use for every day for yes. that question.
So what you're saying is that, interestingly, we were, what the pilot has thrown up, one advantage of it is that some of the way we went about it was slightly haphazard. And now, with the digital checklist in place, we cover all of the information in the department clearly and appropriately, whereas before, there may have been people who were slipping through the gaps.
And how have you found working with an external supplier? I think Concentric in this case.
Well, we went through the procurement process, and I was part of that when we looked at the different possible providers. And I can say from our perspective that from the inception of the project, Concentric has been engaged and helpful. And we have had support for all the things we've wanted to do. For example, we've got a video that we've made to educate patients about age-related macular degeneration with frequently asked questions. And they very rapidly uploaded that for us, obviously with proper clinical governance around that. For our information leaflets, engaged with that and helpful, and also provided generic ones that are wide, you know, available UK-wide. And for our procedures, where we have to add new procedures which aren't already on the Concentric, as it were, menu, they've been able to upload those for us. That's taken a bit more time. There's been some work around that from their end and from ours, but they've remained engaged throughout, and they've come up with a solution to make it much easier for the teams within the different departments to be able to add their very specific consents that they may not do across the nation, but they may do in Oxford. So that's worked out pretty well.
And also, I will, in the beginning, in the pre-pilot, it was very flexible, because when we arised the question about, we need people who can consent, but people who need to access, but don't modify the consent, is when they was very flexible and create consenters and viewers, as you suggested.
Yes, because I thought that would be more helpful. But they've been very helpful with that, and also onboarding and information to help with onboarding. Yes. All the things that you have to learn about, because they've had experience in several other trusts, or more than several other trusts, I think they've been able to use that experience with us. So we've been very happy with working with them.
Are there any other comments you wanted to make about the pilot project and kind of the rollout within ophthalmology before we then perhaps move to your reflections on some advice for the rest of the institution as we roll it out more broadly?
I suppose one thing I'd say is the other thing to consider is procedures. So there is a repertoire of procedures within Concentric that you can use. And for ophthalmology, I broke it down into all the different subsets of ophthalmology. So, for example, medical retina, vitreoretinal surgery, oculoplastics, looked at all the procedures with the teams and checked that they had all the procedures that they wanted within Concentric so that it's an easy process to click, click, click. You get to the procedure you need that you do regularly. Now, in Oxford, obviously, there are some more specific or specialised procedures that might be undertaken that need a bespoke consent for. And there are two ways of doing that. I won't go into all the logistics, or not the logistics, the minutiae of that, but there are ways of being able to add a new consent that can be used for other people, both by the person who wants to introduce that and also more generically for the team. And there are we have a protocol, an algorithm of how you do that. So that's also been one of the hurdles along the way. Through the pilot, we found that out. Information leaflets, update them before you go, and also procedures, check it before you go, and also team, make sure that they are engaged.
I would like to add how important it is when they make the consent, they have the tipos, consent for one, and consent for capacity, no capacity, and for adults and child, which is very good. And the program identifies what kind of consent they need to use.
So, I couldn't agree more. It's very clear within Concentric,
yes,
as to which consent you already know, because that's your field. But for example, for an individual that doesn't have capacity, you want to go to consent form 4, and it's quite clear how you go about that. And I think your comment there is we've explored that a little bit within the IT project around this, again, headed up by Bill Renwick and the team, as to exactly how we approach consent form 2, consent form 1, consent form 4. Because we used to have a consent form 3 in the OUH in the paper form, and that's now not required because everything's covered off by 1, 2 and 4.
So how have you found working with the supplier? In this case, obviously, Concentric were procured via an open procurement process. Have you found the technology to be easy to use? And did you feel that it was easy to work with the company?
Yes, is the answer. Very easy. I think they were very helpful with us. The setup mainly, though, I think has been driven, as I said, by the project lead, Bill, and that has been our main support. And I've been very impressed with the way that that's been implemented, with the support with the team, George Lockerbie, Bill, and the interface with Concentric has been very regular, very frequent. And the one or two things that we found difficult and needed ironing out were adding the procedures. But we worked together in a way that's been very, I think, very productive. So, yes, I would say it's a very, I reckon it's a pretty smooth transition for us. But I appreciate that, you know, we are quite we're quite digital ready because we do a lot of imaging. We already, in 2001, I went through the procurement process for our own electronic patient record when we chose our electronic patient record. So we were already in that sort of space, if I can put it like that. So having Concentric coming into that fitted.
It feels like there've been an awful lot of people across OUH who've supported this project. You know, it's obviously come in by the hill in the first place. You know, we've had procurement involved with the selection of the company. We've had Bill and the team in IT supporting a lot of the infrastructure that's required and the interface with the company. We've had numerous people across governance committees who've had to deal with making sure that the pregnancy question was answered appropriately and things like that. I mean, that feels like a massive layer of coordination that you've had to do across the institution.
And also the communication across the team. That took a lot of time for when I started it off, setting that up. And then I've just been extremely grateful to Lydia for taking on all the training roles, because that's not possible to do on your own, as well as all the other administrative and sorting out the clinical governance issues have been quite time consuming, and creating new forms and liaising with the teams to, because you mentioned a lot of people involved. There's a lot of nursing staff involved, a lot of allied health professionals, trainees, all of whom have contributed to make sure that this has worked.
And so it is a big job to make them understand the different point of view. It's not the same a person who do EPR, coding, who the person who need to use that form in the case of the outpatient checklist. It was lucky we have a person who understand, which was Sarah Taylor, who understand what we needed for cover that that premium question.
So what we're talking about here is once we had made the generic form for our patients, we then wanted to translate that into digital as well, because gone to digital consent, what we don't want is a paper checklist. We want everything to be digital. So luckily, there's a very coherent team, a very helpful and cooperative with what we need and what they have to provide. And they helped us digitise the form as well. Now, interestingly, we've just done two audits on that. And it's clear to me that it's not completely fit for purpose. After the audit, there's one question on it that the way it's written, and we thought we'd covered it, but this is one where audit really helps, because the question, the way we couched it, is not easy to actually determine whether you're supposed to write yes, no, or not applicable. So we've just redone that as well. So it has been a lot of iterations and a lot of work on it, but we've had speedy responses and we've had a lot of buy-in from everybody that's been involved. So I'd say it was a very coherent, well-run project.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And I think we've brought out lots of themes here around some of the support that you need to do these sorts of projects, but also the importance of people like yourselves who are championing that project, who, you know, see the benefit to the service and are prepared to put in that effort to really push that forwards. And hopefully you've ended up with a not just a digital consent solution that is better than your consent form, but also better Wi-Fi, better other forms, better processes. And all of that's contributed to making the service more efficient.
Also, more open-minded, the things can be done, you know, because the idea, why I'm going to change if it's not working the Wi-Fi, now is an excuse. Now everything can be done. I take my positive message about that. Everything can be done in the hospital and we can change for be more digital healthcare people using more the technology, who can make less problem to thinking how I'm going to do that is going to be there.
I think by having introduced it, a lot of people have got a lot more confidence about the way forward with other things. And I think that's the case. It's been a good experience, and I've very much enjoyed working with the team and with Lydia doing it.
I think that's a great message to take away. Really, is it can be done. You know, these things are possible, which is fantastic. Do you have any final closing thoughts for colleagues across the institution who will be rolling out digital consent in their own departments? Any particular hints and tips or things you'd like them to take away from this podcast?
Can I go first on that one?
Okay. Advice is engage all the staff. Doesn't matter if they are going to use or not.
Yes.
And also ensure that all the staff are trained and confident in using the system. And please to be open to ask. As much as they ask, more easy they are going to learn it.
So I would agree with all that. And I think the most important thing is I think in each department, they need to find a champion for it. And then that champion identifies a lead in clinical, in the sense of two perhaps trainees, a lead in administration so that they know how to view the consent, and a lead in the allied health professionals and nursing staff. So they all work together. The whole department gets emailed and verbal discussions to make it start, and then it's very much a question of keeping everyone on board. And if you've got key team members who, for example, if you're in the clinic and you click on it and you think, oh, I can't remember how to do it, or, oh, this doesn't seem to be working. You know, I'll do it on my phone instead. But knowing that you can do it on your phone instead, if that's available to you, knowing that you can go next door and use the signature pad, having the team around so you can just, so the, it's a bit like a cascade reaction. You just need to make sure that there are enough people to be around to help. We've been lucky because we've had Lydia. And departments where there isn't a Lydia, if you've got the champion, they need to make sure that they've identified these key members of staff to help them make sure it happens and to iron out the difficulties and to be aware at the moment that they've still got Lydia to call on should they wish to.
Thank you so much, Susan and Lydia. It's been fantastic having you on the podcast and a real insight into how these projects go and how much effort goes into producing these new technology advances that help us with ultimately with serving patients better.
Thank you for asking.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Hill's Digital Innovation Podcast. Find out more about our work bringing digital technologies into the NHS at www.thehilloxford.org. You'll see details of our open access events as well as applications to programmes such as our flagship Market Access Accelerator for startups looking to work with the NHS. Don't forget to also check out Series 1 and 2 of the podcast.